Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. Today's episode is about the Constitution. It's a clear-eyed assessment of the assaults on it by the Trump administration and a deep discussion of how we should think about constitutional interpretation and constitutional defense. Things aren't good, there's no denying that. But things also, perhaps, aren't as bad, at least not yet, as the most shrill of the doomers insist. To dig into all of this, I'm joined by Evan Burnick. He's a law professor at Northern Illinois University and has been one of the most thoughtful, persistent, and effective critics of the risible scholarship the Trump administration is using to justify its assault on birthright citizenship. Before we turn to my conversation with Evan, I wanted to let you know there's an easy and free way you can listen to Reimagining Liberty without interruptions from ads or sponsorships. Just head to my Patreon and click join for free. You'll get a special feed you can add to your favorite podcast app that doesn't contain any ads. You'll also get my new essays sent to your inbox. And if you value Reimagining Liberty and want to support the show, there are options for that too. As a supporter, you'll get all new episodes a full week early. To learn more, check out my Patreon at patreon.com/AaronRossPowell or look for the link in the show notes. With that, here's my discussion with Evan. So, Evan, how's the Constitution holding up?
That's the big question, isn't it? So I hate to do the lawyerly thing whereby I say it depends on exactly what you're asking, but I'm going to go ahead and do that anyway. If the question is, does the Constitution that we trace all the way back to 1788 function in the way that it was designed in 1788? The answer is absolutely not, and it hasn't for some time. I would actually go so far as to say that the Constitution of 1868, following the ratification of the 14th Amendment, marked the transformation of the constitutional order into something that was just fundamentally different than what existed following the Philadelphia Convention in 1788. So the Constitution has been transformed in profound ways to the point where what we call the Constitution now is just so different from anything that was originally imagined that I often find myself, asking whether I should even talk about the Constitution as a continuous thing. That being said, we can ask certain questions about the kinds of commitments that we have associated with the Constitution. Over the course of time, over the course of the past couple of centuries, things like the separation of powers, the idea of a division of authority between three functionally different branches of government that compete with one another, none of which dominates the other, the related concept of checks and balances, whereby these different institutions prevent one another from exceeding their authorities and dominating the others, and the protection of individual rights. The Constitution was not originally designed with a Bill of Rights. That was a price of ratification demanded by states that wouldn't have ratified it without one. But there's a long and complicated story behind it. But however, at the end of it, we get the idea that the Constitution is designed to safeguard individual rights. Not always, but with a degree of consistency and commitment, such that you know where you stand, in part because the Constitution stands in front of you. And I would say that on all of those, very basic commitments, and I suppose we could add federalism, the idea that that there is a division of power between governmental units, at the federal level, the national government, and state governments. And state governments exercise primary control over civic life, but the federal government serves a coordinating function and steps in, is empowered to step in where states violate individual rights. And I wouldn't say that any of the those, you know, overarching structural commitments that we associate with the Constitution are being fulfilled in any particular consistent way. The idea that the branches will jealously guard their powers against one another and prevent one another from exceeding their, you know, their delimited authorities, really hasn't been. This is not a commitment that has been fulfilled for any extensive period of time in American history. Almost immediately, you get the development of national political parties that align their commitments across institutions, across branches, and the result is that the separation of powers, the idea that people's political ambitions will be grounded in their associations with particular institutions, gives way to a separation of parties, whereby if you have members of, you know, the Republican or the Democratic Party in charge of two or more branches of government, then you really don't have a lot of competition between institutions. The commitment to individual rights, the idea that the Constitution is a safeguard for individual rights, like, yes and no, it depends what rights there are and where you are in terms of your experience of them. My Fourth Amendment rights are, you know, relatively well respected, but that's because I am, you know, a comparatively socioeconomic elite law professor at a university who teaches about the Fourth Amendment, not a socioeconomically marginal person who is disproportionately policed, arrested, and prosecuted. And my rights aren't violated very often. When they are, to the extent that they are, I have resources that I can use to draw upon to identify, yes, I have a constitutional claim, yes, I could pursue it. But that's not something that most people can have. So I think that at a very general level, we don't have the separation of powers we tell ourselves we have. Our experience of individual rights protection is contingent upon circumstances that it really isn't supposed to be contingent upon by constitutional design. And so we're not in a particularly good place. And I haven't even mentioned the ascendance to power of an executive branch that has very little regard for anything that I have just described, and is acting on its lack of commitment to separation of powers and individual rights at a remarkable rate that our system is just not equipped to deal with.
There's a lot in there, and I want to unpack some of it. I was thinking as you were talking, my daughter is taking high school AP government this semester, and I keep wondering how profoundly weird it must be to be an AP government teacher right now and having to answer questions like, what are the powers of Congress? What is the Supreme Court doing? What are the powers of the executive? These are much stranger questions than they were a year ago. And I think one of the things you said that was particularly interesting was this kind of shift in people's identity from people in government, from like a role-based identity to a partisan or tribal-based identity. Because you're right, it is the case that it seems like there was a time when people would have thought of themselves as a congressman first, or a judge first, or a bureaucrat first. And we, like libertarians, used to talk all the time about the perverse incentives that this often created. This was the like public choice theory of, you know, why do bureaucracies grow? It's because like their interest is in themselves qua bureaucrat first, and they want resources to grow their own fiefdoms and so on. Why do they aggregate power? The same incentives apply, but we seem to have broken that people are just, yes, I have a professional role, but I am willing to burn it to the ground because the role or the identity that means more to me is as a member of this political tribe or this identity group, or, I mean, I think as we're watching now, this kind of personality cult. I will subvert every other interest I have to that. I will humiliate myself. I will strip myself of power. I will sap my own resources, and so on. And yeah, this seems to have broken the checks and balances, because the checks and balances depended upon people being jealous of their own fiefdoms to a degree. What's going on there? I mean, I know this is a little bit orthogonal to the specifically how the Constitution is holding up, but this seems like something worth digging into, because it does seem to be like the background story of our current political moment.
It's the background story of our current political moment, but I think that in this particular regard, our current political moment is a recapitulation of a theme that can really be traced to almost the beginning of the Republic. You know, you have these kind of self-similar fractals, periods of time in which you have structurally similar situations happening over and over and over again. And I don't think that we, you know, blame the constitutional design enough for this, because I do think that the goal of aligning interests with institutions is a good goal, and yet it very quickly became disaligned, and in ways that, you know, given that the political parties were not invented shortly after the ratification of the Constitution, were not all that difficult to predict. So you have very quickly after the ratification of the Constitution, what we now can recognize as partisan alignments in connection with debates over the constitutionality of Alexander Hamilton's treasury program and his economic policies. And very quickly, we get the developments of what are now recognizable political parties and coalitions across institutions that are now working with one another rather than checking and balancing one another. Very quickly, this design feature of the Constitution just it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And what we have seen over the course of time is, you know, just recognition that this has happened again and again and again. And it is easy to say at any given moment, why isn't anybody following the framers' design? Why isn't anybody jealously guarding their institutional prerogatives? They're not jealously guarding their institutional prerogatives because their incentives are not aligned with guarding their institutional prerogatives. And because the Constitution is not designed to align their incentives in quite the way that we might have hoped that it was. The public choice problem that you've described is real, and it's a testament to just how intractable that those problems can be. That even if you get a bunch of geniuses together and they come up with a document that is ratified by, through relatively democratic processes under the constraints of the time, you know, it may not work as designed very quickly.
Does this mean then that if we're looking out at the current moment and the threats, and I want to get to how the Supreme Court has been responding and whether the institutions have basically already collapsed or if they're still holding. But if we look out at it then, does this mean that the questions we need to wrestle with are effectively cultural and personal and psychological, in the sense that this is not a matter of institutional design, that we couldn't necessarily have designed institutions better to have mitigated this kind of situation, right? Because the political culture changed, the broader culture changed, the social issues changed, and those then pushed in these directions. And I ask particularly because there's this background, like, ongoing conversation of, okay, what do we do in the current moment, right? Like, well, how do we defend the institutions of liberal democracy in the current moment? But also, assuming that we make it through the current moment, that, you know, this authoritarian moment passes and we get beyond it, how do we reform things? Like the political science kind of questions of, we can't go back to the prior status quo. What kind of reforms are needed? Do we need to change institutions, laws, amend the Constitution, whatever it looks like? It sounds like what you're saying is that there's almost a degree of like mootness to that, because if we find ourselves in another social, psychological, political, cultural moment like this one, it's all going to break down again.
So what I would say is that you've got to kind of you often, at least I find myself navigating this tension between recognizing that, you know, appeals to constitutional fidelity, appeals to the separation of powers and checks and balances and respect for individual rights can move people. And they can move people in profound ways to take actions that they might not otherwise take, even if objectively looking over the course of American history, you find that those values have been more honored in the breach than actually followed. Regardless of how well the Constitution is designed, in terms of separating powers, in providing for checks and balances, and more generally, in respect of generating liberal democracy, it's what we have now, and starting from scratch isn't something that we can do. In fact, even suggesting that we ought to start with scratch is taken as tantamount to hating America or calling for some kind of revolution. And in that respect, I think that we have to talk like this. We have to say, we have to condemn legislators who are, you know, failing to do what we understand on the basis of this shared cultural understanding of the Constitution to do their duties, while also recognizing that it's not surprising that they're not doing their duties. And also, once we get out of this, maybe it's time to take a harder look at some of the institutions from which we now some of this veneration that, you know, imagines a constitution that has more safeguards for liberal democracy than we actually have at all at this stage. So, I mean, one of the thinkers, the scholars that I find myself often going back to at this particular moment is W.E.B. Du Bois, whose book Black Reconstruction in America is for my money still the best thing like ever written, not only about Reconstruction, but our constitutional order more generally. And what Du Bois finds in the efforts by Republicans to try to figure out Reconstruction Republicans who are supporting the protection of Black civil rights, what he finds in their discussions about, you know, whether the Southern states left the Union, were they ever in the Union, all of these what he calls fetishistic debates about constitutional fidelity and exactly what the Constitution requires in the situation, he says, you know, this really took a lot of time and also obscured the reality that, you know, a constitutional order that does not involve racial hierarchy and enslavement is just so fundamentally different than one that does, that you might as well have embraced the existence of a constitutional revolution and not merely reconstructed, but created a new constitutional order fundamentally committed to the values that you are not now trying to kind of eke out of this antiquated order that just failed to prevent a civil war. And at the same time, he was able to lament that the 14th Amendment wasn't given effect, that the right to vote that the 15th Amendment was designed to secure was not respected, that laws, that Reconstruction laws were going under-enforced, and we had racial apartheid in violation of the Constitution for decades. So there's this constant struggle between saying, look, I know that people value this, and I know that we tell ourselves that it's valuable, and it can encourage people to do great things. The Republicans would not have done what they did unless they believed that the Constitution was consistent with Black civil rights and an end to slavery. And yet, their attachment to this constitutional order, Du Bois argued, and I think he was correct in certain respects, prevented them from doing things that might have actually enabled them to entirely realize their vision. So once we emerge from this, if we emerge from this, I don't think that we can say, well, phew, okay, we restored the Constitution, it's fine now. Something has gone very badly wrong, not just with respect to who happened to get elected, but to the system that enabled these people to get elected. For us to just move on and say, yay, we've restored our constitutional order.
Yeah, the veneration thing. One of my formative moments as a law student, kind of my like political ideologically formative moments as a law student, was taking a constitutional law seminar. And we had been discussing a line of cases, and how I, off the top of my head, cannot actually remember which line of cases it was or what the central question was. But it was an issue where the Supreme Court, had ruled one way on a particular issue, another way on another issue, a third way on a third issue. And we were discussing, okay, what's like the guiding principle that runs throughout this? How do you tie these cases together in a way that we can then extract some sort of rule, constitutional rule that's at play? And I remember thinking, you know what? I'm not buying it. And I'm not buying it in the same way that when you like hardcore comic book fans who say, well, you know, like the Incredible Hulk seemed to have this power in this issue, but didn't use that same power 50 issues later. And what's the continuity story at play? And the answer that seemed obvious to me with both the Incredible Hulk and the Supreme Court in this line of cases was there isn't one. It's just inconsistent. It's the justices were inconsistent, or it was a different set of justices making decision that was not consistent with the prior one, that there wasn't some, they weren't like this oracle that comes up with reasoned decisions, but instead. And I understood why, like in law school, you have to teach, lawyers have to like understand the case law and extract precedent and all of that. But there was like this unwillingness to acknowledge they're just people making decisions motivated by, they can make mistakes or they can be motivated by bad reasons. And I think about that in light of, if we watch the Supreme Court now and the decisions the six justice conservative majority is making. And forever, there was this narrative you'd get from progressives of these conservative justices, like FedSoc justices, for lack of a better term, are really just partisan hacks. And then conservatives and a lot of like right libertarians will push back hard on that and say, like, well, no, there's these principled, you know, you might not agree with their judicial philosophy, but it's there. And but it seems now like it. Or is it wrong now, looking at, say, like the shadow docket decisions and the way that they keep, they're not ruling directly against Trump, but they're like enabling him to keep doing these things that seem on their face to be constitutionally problematic. Is the Supreme Court, like, is that veneration misplaced? Is it just a bunch of partisan hacks at this point?
So I do think that the veneration of the Supreme Court, to the extent that it still exists, I think we're seeing diminishing returns on that veneration investment. And I think that that's actually a good thing. The Supreme Court over the course of its history has not been particularly good in terms of interpreting and giving effect to the Constitution. It's a hard thing to say, but I think it's true. But the reason that I resist calling the court as a body a bunch of partisan hacks is because there's kind of an ambiguity in the phrase partisan hacks that I think is worth teasing out here. So I don't think that the Supreme Court, any of the justices, think to themselves, how can I best serve MAGA right now and guide their decisions in accordance with the let's maximize gains for MAGA principle. I think the closest justice for whom that is a functional explanation, if not a psychological explanation, is probably Justice Alito. But setting Justice Alito aside, what I think is that you have a bunch of very conservative justices who are not just a bunch, they are a supermajority, who have been selected to realize certain principles that the conservative legal movement has associated with the Constitution for decades, and who are being very, very aggressive about it in the worst possible context for liberal democracy. So, for example, the idea that the president has, under Article 2, the authority to unilaterally remove from office the heads of federal agencies, including independent agencies, is not a new idea. That's the overruling of Humphrey's executor, which is the case that still, for now, it won't for long, stand for the proposition that the heads of independent agencies can be insulated from presidential removal by what are called for cause restrictions, has been a conservative white whale for longer than I've been alive. However, overruling Humphrey's executor in this environment doesn't just give a president more control over removing the heads of federal agencies. It gives Donald Trump that authority. And the justices do not care about that to the degree that I think they should. They are professionally conditioned, I think, and have been conditioned by the conservative legal movement to not think about who happens to be occupying any given office or who happens to have supported any particular legislation in deciding whether it's constitutional. It's either constitutional or it's not. But what Donald Trump kind of forces them to do, or I think should force them to do, and they're not doing, is to recognize that to the degree that you're giving this administration, run, so to speak, by this person, more power than they previously had, you are enabling them to violate the Constitution more often than you otherwise would by just keeping precedents in place. And just framing it that way, you know, I am confident that, you know, a Justice Gorsuch or a Justice Kavanaugh would say, well, as soon as you've said that, you've basically said that, you know, the Constitution's meaning should turn on who's in office. But let me just give you one example of what I see is the problem and why that's not a satisfactory answer to me. So in the case Trump v. Casa, where the courts held that what are known as universal injunctions that prevent a policy from being enforced anywhere in the United States are not authorized by the Judiciary Act of 1791, there's a footnote in which the Justice Barrett, writing for the majority, says, at oral arguments, the Solicitor General of the United States did say that he understood the administration to be bound by the reasoning of Supreme Court decisions. And including that in a footnote, as if it means something, does, to some degree, recognize, at least implicitly, that the content of the law turns upon, to some degree, confidence in the good faith of the administration that happens to be before the court. And I don't think that you can entirely abstract in thinking about what the Constitution means or how you're going to go about enforcing it from, you know, the actual conduct that you can expect from the actors who are responding to your rulings. If John Sauer promises that the administration will follow the constitutional reasoning of the court, and you say, well, because of that, something legally follows, you are telling me that actually the identity of people does matter. And I think that the administration is aggressively pursuing across a variety of spaces an anti-constitutional agenda in ways that the court just is not prepared to acknowledge because it is just so conditioned to think you've got to assume good faith on the part of members of the executive branch.
If this then further breaks down in the sense that it becomes obvious the administration is not following through on that good faith, is this the presumption of regularity that we sometimes hear about? Is that the term of art?
Yeah, this is the presumption of regularity. It's sometimes in outside of the executive branch, it can be referred to as the presumption of constitutionality. The idea is that you're generally dealing with law-abiding actors who you can give the benefit of the doubt when they say or do things. It's not a blank check; it's just a presumption. It's rebuttable, but the very fact that it's there tells you that in some purposes, in some contexts, we're not just thinking about what the Constitution means. We're thinking about the actual behavior of people who say that they are acting fully constitutionally, that they're complying with court orders, that they're doing this, they're doing that. And that's why I say that I don't think that you can totally abstract your constitutional or your legal analysis from the behavior of people who will be ordering the conduct of government in light of your rulings. And you don't have to overrule Humphrey's executor today. You don't have to overrule Humphrey's executor during this administration. And you don't have to overrule Humphrey's executor functionally overrule Humphrey's executor, render it ineffective as actually doing anything through an unsigned order that does not acknowledge, much less grapple with the existence of arguments on the other side, en route to eventually coming up with an opinion saying, actually, all of this is okay, and go ahead.
Does this then mean, though, because going back to the very beginning, we were talking about kind of how much the branches jealously guard their own power, it still does feel like Supreme Court justices are pretty jealous about their status and authority. They're nine people who made it to the absolute top, and they tend to be, you don't really get up there unless you're somewhat professionally arrogant. If it becomes really obvious that the Trump administration is not going to obey the Supreme Court, the judicial branch in general, do you think that they become then the conservative justices, with the exception of maybe Alito, become more skeptical in their rulings?
So, a couple things. One is the reason I think that the Supreme Court justices are jealous of their institutional authority is in part because they can be. They're not going anywhere. They've been appointed. They can't be removed. In theory, they could be impeached. That's not going to happen. You know, we had a trial of this during the early Republic and an effort to impeach a justice who was relentlessly partisan that went absolutely nowhere and kind of set a precedent going forward that it's not even worth trying. So they can afford to be. Second of all, what the administration is doing very carefully, and I do want to stress, like, there are a lot of idiots that work for this government. There are a lot of non-idiots. There are genuinely clever lawyers who know how to play a certain kind of political game, and they're playing it now, which is that they're drawing a distinction between lower courts, which they are saying are out of control, determined to thwart the president's agenda, partisan hacks, and the Supreme Court, which they are confident in, they will follow, they will obey, and will not offend in any way. And the reason that the administration really thinks that it can afford to do this is because if it is going to say, look, district courts will go out of our way to try to avoid your rulings, and in extreme cases actually do things that get us charged with contempt, it will take a very long time before any of that makes its way to the Supreme Court. And in the meantime, the status quo is that the administration can either do what it wants or prepare to do what it wants as soon as the Supreme Court issues a stay that prevents some lower court order from going into effect. Eventually, you might have a situation in, you know, one of the big cases that I'm looking at in this regard is birthright citizenship, where the Supreme Court might say, look, this thing is unconstitutional, and then it would be up to the administration to decide, okay, well, there's no way we can get around this. We're either going to obey or not obey. But in the context of most legal controversies that the administration has found itself in, there's always a way that it can find a way to do what it wants without specifically contradicting any order that the Supreme Court will ever find itself making, and I assume that it will continue to try to do this. Like the closest thing to the Supreme Court actually saying, look, we've had enough with this, was involved an immigration case in which a U.S. attorney represented to the government that these planes would not be flying until a certain time, and then they flew before that. And you got the closest thing to a sharp Supreme Court statement saying you misrepresented what was going on the ground. And then you have this angry dissent from Alito. I think what the administration has learned from that episode is that there's a lot that it can do on its own by way of, you know, essentially pretending that lower courts don't have much authority over it without actually offending the Supreme Court.
I want to dig into the kind of constitutional philosophy angle for a second, because something you said earlier made me think of this, which is this, like, kind of binding to or only thinking in the context of the rules of the Constitution or the rules as you have interpreted them to be, because the Constitution is a relatively short document. The language is heavily interpretable and meaning is slippery and all that French philosophy stuff. And then kind of looking beyond it to the impact on the world. And I'm thinking of that. I had an old colleague at the Cato Institute who once remarked to me in passing that the Cato Institute had a department of constitutional studies, and he thought that instead that should be the department of law or legal studies, because the the Constitution itself is not the end goal. The end goal is like a system of liberty and a government that supports it. And to the extent that the Constitution points in that direction, good, to the extent that it doesn't, bad. But the idea is not to be strictly constitutional in your end goals. It's to be pro-liberty and limited government and so on. And I think about that as I'm looking out at the state of legal scholarship and legal punditry and among circles that, you know, you and I have run in, that there does seem to be this kind of, well, the effects don't matter, or the all that matters is getting the constitutional question right. It's the same as the attitude against in law school when you're analyzing a constitutional question. Your law professors tell you, like, you should talk about the policy questions too as part of it. Like, what would the effects of this ruling be in addition to? And that often gets like sneered at in these, like, that's outside of the bounds of how you should think about legal questions. And maybe that's correct, but I have been struck in the last, you know, 10 months of this administration by how many people seem to be willing to kind of ignore the profoundly authoritarian effects of what we're seeing by just talking along these like very narrowly legal grounds. And what I'm interested in is that a problem? Is that a failure of legal philosophy? Is it a rhetorical way to kind of excuse, you know, like, I actually like what's going on, but I don't want to come out and say it. So instead, this is another way to support what's going on. Like, it's just, this has been troubling to watch.
Yeah, I flat out do not believe that there is any person whose view is worth reckoning with. Who does not believe that the effects of legal rulings matter, either morally or in respect of whether we should think about whether those rulings were correct to begin with. The Supreme Court, in deciding that Donald Trump was not excluded by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment from the Constitution, from eligibility because he participated in insurrection against the United States, relied heavily on concerns about what the effects of such a ruling would be on the country. In deciding that the president is immune from prosecution for official acts for official acts conducted while in office, once he leaves office, the court's engaged in questions about what kind of effect it would have on presidential conduct and their vigor in maintaining the prerogatives of the office if they knew that they could face criminal prosecution for what they did. There are too many doctrines, constitutional and otherwise, to name that depend upon the effects of decisions. So I don't buy that. I don't think that when Justice Kavanaugh says in concurrence that he is okay with a stop and frisk policy that involves raiding Home Depots on the basis of perception that people who speak Spanish and are probably illegal entrants is not thinking about the effects of that decision. He just does not think that the effects of that decision are constitutionally salient enough to find a constitutional problem with that policy. So I think that we should always, that's the right way to think about things. We should think about the effects of policies. We should think about the effects of policies in determining whether they are legal or not, because the Constitution is not an end of itself. It's as you point out, it's a means to the facilitation of liberal democracy, to the extent it's a means to anything worthwhile at all. And it's in thinking about, you know, how we should evaluate constitutional language and think about what it means, we have to have recourse to that design. And so we need to consider whether interpreting it a certain way would have effects that are consistent with that design. You know, there's the letter of the Constitution, there's the text, and then there's the spirit. There are the purposes that it's designed to achieve. And if thinking about what a provision that is unclear, as many provisions are unclear, means on the basis of text, you need to have recourse to the purpose in order to figure out what the whether a particular purpose will be fulfilled. You have to think about the effects.
Is that the limiting factor then on that theory of interpretation? Because if you say just, I think you should take into account the effects of a particular ruling, and that should, to some extent, determine your ruling, it's easy to say, okay, so then what you're arguing is that we basically toss the whole thing out, and everything becomes maybe something more analogous to like common law rulings, but where the judge looks at the particular situation, assesses, tries to limit the harm that in their decision. We maybe like precedent matters a little bit and that you're trying to tie it back in, but mainly you're like looking at the situation as it exists in the moment. And if that's the case, then that would mean like you're basically throwing out the Constitution. It's whatever the good effects are is what you should do. And then the argument is about what the good effects are. And both of us have spent enough time in kind of policy world to know that people have very different opinions about what good effects are, what the right answer looks like, and so on. So if that's a legitimate objection to what, or a reasonable objection to what you just said, or reasonable concern about what you just said, is that then the backstop that we need? It's not just that you're throwing everything out, it's that you're reading everything in light of what was this thing's purpose to begin with. In the same way that we might say like the rules for a particular sport aren't ends in and of themselves, they should be read in the context of like, we're trying to have a good game at the end of all of this. And if the rules get in the way, they should be changed.
Right. So even the most doctrinaire textualist is not going to tell you that having recourse to the purpose of a provision or the structural design that it serves is categorically illegitimate. What you can't do is appeal to purpose or structure in order to defeat the plain or ordinary meaning of the words, either of a statute or the Constitution. And by the time the cases get litigated all the way to the Supreme Court, it is often the case that the very fact that they've got litigated all the way to the Supreme Court evinces that the ordinary or plain meaning of the text just doesn't point unidirectionally in one way, otherwise nobody would bother litigating it. So you have to have recourse to something else, and the question is, okay, where are you going to have recourse to? And even within textualism, even as practiced by people like the late Justice Scalia or the currently living Judge Frank Easterbrook, you can have recourse to purpose once you have exhausted your analysis of the text and found that, try as you might, you're still not sure whether the answer is X or Y. And I think that is, you know, even though, you know, I can point to a Scalia or Easterbrook article in which they say that, I think it is still very common for justices, for judges, and for conservative commentators who call themselves textualists to turn up their nose at purposivism and say that it's illegitimate to consider purpose. And what I try to stress is nobody is arguing that purpose should trump, no pun intended, the clear meaning of text. It is a consideration to bring in once you have exhausted all of your canons of construction, all of your dictionary definitions, everything that you can possibly throw at this thing and you're still not sure. And I would say that is often the case when you find something litigated all the way to the Supreme Court. And then I think there is room for purpose. And I suppose the other thing that I would say is that, like, you know, people can disagree about what the purpose or effects of language is. People can they can also disagree about the meaning of words. All text assumes a communicative context that you need to look into. The very fact that this is being litigated through the appellate level suggests that even after people have looked at all that, they're still not sure. So purpose is not just this, you know, controversial addition to this uncontroversial thing that everybody could do and get the right answer to. It's recourse once you have found that there's already controversy and you've got to dissolve it in some way.
To close us out, what do you see as, we talked a fair amount about differing methods of interpretation. We've talked a fair amount about the incentives that exist in these institutions and the way that those have gone wrong, and the dangers of the moment. And so I'll go back to that question of, if we get through this, you know, that Trumpism is in the rearview mirror at some point in the next handful of years, and we're in a situation for reform, and you're looking out at the judiciary as it has been acting in this moment, what do you think are the most needed concrete reforms?
So I am really wary at this present moment of trying to develop a recipe for constitutional cookshops of the future, because I think that we are in a moment that I haven't experienced over the course of my life, where just a ton of things are possible. Everything from reform to just revolutionary rupture of the kind that Du Bois was talking about. Because what the Trump administration is trying to do right now is revolutionary. What they are trying to do is conjure together from the most reactionary moments of our constitutional past, you know, an engine of constitutional destruction that we haven't seen since, I would say, the first redemption, the violent overthrow of reconstructed governments in the former Confederate states in the service of white supremacy. I think that what we need to do right now is focus less on exactly what we are going to do once we get out of this and think together about how to get out of this, and do that by looking to some of this more successful constitutional struggles that we've seen throughout our constitutional history. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about the abolition movements and how it led into the Republican Party and how it was able to accomplish what it was able to accomplish. And there wasn't one way that it worked. It worked in a variety of different ways. You had radical abolitionist lawyers who thought the Constitution was illegitimate litigating on behalf of alleged fugitives under the Fugitive Slave Act. You had radical abolitionist newspaper editors publicizing those cases and creating effectively publicity that led to mobs around courtrooms, that led to the springing of fugitives even when judges decided the cases in the wrong way. You had efforts to elaborate a constitutional vision that, you know, dubious historical accuracy, but served the needs of the moment, whereby all the framers were actually committed to eliminating slavery as quickly as possible. This is Lincoln, you know, the framers wanted to put slavery in the course of its ultimate extinction. Like, no, they didn't, but Lincoln thought that they did and said that they did, and people believed that they did, and we got a abortive constitutional revolution based on the premise that they did that almost led to a new constitution founded on that principle. So you got lawyers, you got direct action, you've got actually, you know, this is an uncomfortable part of our abolitionist history, but Frederick Douglass wrote an article entitled, "Is It Moral to Kill a Kidnapper?" It was about legitimate violent self-defense in response to violent state action. Without calling for any of such action myself, I will just observe that there have been very few periods of constitutional struggle over the course of our history that have been without violence in response to violence. So I don't think that I can tell you exactly what we should be doing several months from now where we get out of this. I think we need to be creative and we need to pool resources and draw upon different experiences up against this government and draw upon these multifarious traditions of freedom struggles in order to come up with something that can build a movement that's large enough to get rid of it. I realize that's unsatisfying, but I think that a lot of the you know, efforts to devise a plan, here's exactly what we should do, here's how we should treat the previous regime. I've seen people that I respect make those arguments. I think that they are misguided. I don't think that we can plan for something like that. And I think that the best thing that we can do is try to find what works right now and worry about the details of the, you know, the third reconstruction when we get there.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.